Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are opening up the hood of the econometric engine. We're looking at what happens when the road just stops being straight.
Right. We're getting into the curves.
Exactly. We're tackling Chapter 15 of Analysis of Economics Data, and the focus is regression with transformed variables.
And this is such a crucial pivot point in any econometrics course. You know, if you've been following along with the standard OLS, the ordinary least squares models, you've been living in a very, very linear world.
It's a nice, simple world.
Yeah.
Start at A, go to B. It's a straight line, constant speed.
Which is great for an introduction, you know, for learning the basics. But the real world is, well, it's rarely that well-behaved.
Not at all.
Exactly. In the real economy, things curve. They accelerate, they slow down, they plateau. You see diminishing returns everywhere. And I think maybe most importantly, the effect of one thing often depends entirely on the context of something else.
So our mission today is to figure out how we can capture all that messy nonlinear reality without having to throw out our fundamental regression tools.
That's the goal. We are essentially building the ultimate study guide for first-year economics students on what to do when your variables get tricky. We're talking about quadratics, logarithms, and those famously difficult interaction terms.
Oh, the interaction terms, yeah. Definitely. But before we get into all the math, there's a concept that the source material highlights right at the top. It's almost like a cheat code for econometrics. They call it the linearity loophole.
It really does feel like a cheat code, doesn't it? It's the loophole that lets us use our standard OLS estimation for things that are clearly curves. See, students often think, and it's a very common mistake, that for OLS to work, the relationship between your X and your Y has to be a literal straight line.
But that's not quite right.
It's not the actual requirement.
Okay, so let's clarify that. What does OLS actually demand from us?
The real requirement is that the model must be linear in the parameters.
In the parameters. Okay, so the coefficients.
Exactly. The coefficients, your betas, your b values, they have to enter the equation linearly. So you can square your x variable, you can take the log of it, you can multiply it by some other variable z. OLS is a system, it doesn't care what you do to the variables.
It only cares about the coefficients.
It only cares about the coefficients.
So if I have an equation that looks like y equals b1 plus b2 times,
yeah.
Something. Anything.
Yeah.
As long as B1 and B2 are just sitting there being multiplied, we're safe.
You are totally safe. You can bend the variables into pretzels, but as long as the coefficients remain linear, meaning they aren't squared themselves or logged or divided by each other, the math of minimizing the sum of squared residuals still works perfectly.
That is the loophole.
It is.
Yeah.
And it opens up this massive playground of different functional forms while letting us keep our estimation techniques simple.
But, and I think this is the big so what challenge of this entire chapter.
Yeah.
Just because we can run the regression easily doesn't mean we automatically understand what comes out of it.
That is the trap. That is 100% the trap. In a simple linear model, interpretation is a breeze, right? The coefficient is the marginal effect. If X goes...
You can explain it to your grandmother. It's simple.
Exactly. But the second you start squaring things... or logging them.
That simplicity just evaporates.
It's gone. If you have a squared term or a log term, that coefficient you see in the regression table is no longer the marginal effect. It becomes just one part of a more complex calculation. The slope is not constant anymore.
Which means if you just read that regression output blindly, you're going to get the interpretation wrong.
You are almost certainly going to fail the exam question on interpretation. Or, you know, even worse, in the real world, you'll give your future employer really bad advice.
Right.
So the core of our discussion today is really building the toolkit to interpret these models correctly. We're going to break down how to calculate marginal effects, or E, properly. We have to navigate this alphabet soup of AME, MEM, and MER.
A, MEM, MER. Got it.
And we also have to talk about a very specific and kind of sneaky problem called retransformation bias, which can completely ruin your predictions if you're not careful.
And to keep all of this from becoming too abstract, we're going to be grounding our conversation in a specific data set. The source material uses a data set called Earnings Complete.
It's a great data set to anchor our analysis. It's a snapshot from the year 2000, and it's looking at 872 full-time workers.
Okay, so let's get a profile on these people. Who are we actually analyzing here?
It's a pretty broad slice of the workforce. It includes men and women, their age between 25 and 65. The mean annual earnings back in 2000 were about $56,369.
Okay.
And we have data on their education, their age, and this is crucial, their employment sector. So are they in government, the private sector, or are they self-employed?
So that's our sandbox. 872 lives, basically, hidden in these spreadsheet rows. And our goal is to figure out what drives their earnings using these new nonlinear tools. So where do we start?
Let's start with the most fundamental concept that completely shifts when we leave that linear world. Section one, the concept of marginal effects in nonlinear models.
This is the cornerstone.
It absolutely is. In a linear world, like we said, the marginal effect is constant. It's just the slope of the line. If I ask you, what is the effect of being 1 year older on your earnings? In a linear model, you just point to the coefficient for age. That's B2.
And it's the same number whether you're 25 or 65.
It's the same number, which intuitively we all know is probably wrong.
Yeah, that doesn't feel right. Getting a year of experience when you're 25 is a massive boost. You're learning the ropes, you're getting promotions. Getting a year when you're 64, you might be eyeing retirement. That boost is not going to be the same.
Exactly. The return on age likely changes over your life. So in a nonlinear model, let's say a quadratic one where we include an age squared term, the effect of a change in X on Y now depends on the current value of X.
So the marginal effect becomes a moving target.
It's a moving target. It's not a single number anymore, it becomes a function. Technically, we define it as the change in predicted Y divided by the change in X. So delta Y hat over delta X.
Okay, and the source material brings up two ways to actually calculate this moving target. And I remember this confusing me back in the day because they give you different numbers. There's the calculus method and the finite difference method. Let's break those down.
Yeah, this is a really common point of confusion. It all comes down to the distinction between a continuous curve and discrete one-unit steps. The calculus method is the standard in econometrics. It uses the derivative, so did X. It's looking at the slope of the tangent line at one tiny infinitesimal point on the curve.
So it's asking, right at this split second, how fast are earnings changing? It's like a speedometer reading.
That's a perfect analogy. It's the speedometer reading at an exact moment in time. If you have the equation for the curve, you differentiate it with respect to X, you plug in your specific X value, and bam, you get the slope at that point.
Okay. And what about the finite difference method? How's that different?
That method is a bit more brute force. It asks a different question. It asks, if I am at X equals 2 and I actually move all the way to X equals 3, what is the specific change in Y?
So it's not the instantaneous rate, it's the total change over a whole step.
Exactly. You calculate the predicted value at 2, then you calculate it at 3, and you just subtract the first from the second. You are measuring the actual jump over one full unit.
It sounds like they should give the same answer, though.
Only if the line is perfectly straight. On a curve, they will absolutely differ. The source gives a really clear example of this. Imagine a curve that's defined by the equation y equals 12 minus 2 times x minus 3 squared.
Okay, so that's an inverted U shape. I'm picturing a hill.
A hill, exactly. So let's look at the point where x equals 2. If you use the calculus method, you have to take the derivative of that equation.
Right.
The derivative of 12 is 0. The derivative of negative 2 times x minus 3 squared. You use the chain rule, and it works out to be negative 4 times x minus 3.
So our formula for the slope at any point is negative 4 times x minus 3.
Correct. Now, let's plug in our value x equals 2. It becomes negative 4 times 2 minus 3, which is negative 4 times negative 1.
Which is positive 4.
Positive 4. So at the point x equals 2, the curve is rising at a rate of 4. The speedometer says 4.
Okay. Calculus says 4. Now let's try the other method, the finite difference.
So first, we calculate y when x equals 2. We plug 2 into the original equation. 12 minus 2 times 2 minus 3 squared. That's 12 minus 2 times 1, which is 10.
Okay, y is 10.
Now we do it for x equals 3. We plug 3 into the equation. 12 minus 2 times 3 minus 3 squared. That's 12 minus 0, which is 12.
So the jump is from 10 to 12. The change is 2.
The change is 2.
Whoa, that is a huge difference. Calculus says the slope is 4. Finite difference says the gain over the whole unit is 2. Why is there such a big gap?
It's because the curve is flattening out as you move from x2 to bias 3. The calculus method measures the slope right at the start of the step where it's still pretty steep. But over the course of that full step from 2 to 3, the slope gets shallower and shallower. The finite difference method captures the average change over that entire step.
So which one should a student use on an exam? That's the key question.
Right. Unless the question specifically asks for the discrete change or the finite difference, you always, always stick to the calculus method. It is the analytical standard for what we call marginal effects. It's just cleaner. And for very small changes in X, it's the most accurate description of the relationship's dynamic at that point.
Okay, so stick to the derivative. But this creates a problem I see immediately. If the marginal effect changes depending on where you are in the curve, if it's a different number for the 25-year-old versus the 55-year-old, how do I report a result? I can't just hand my professor a list of 872 different marginal effects for every person in the data set.
And you have just hit on section two, the aggregation dilemma.
The aggregation dilemma.
You have a model that says it depends, but you need a summary statistic that says here's the big takeaway. So since the marginal effect varies for every single individual depending on their specific value of X, how do we report a single representative statistic?
And the literature gives us three main ways to handle this. We have AME, MEM, and MER.
That's right. Let's break them down, because knowing the difference is almost always a test question. First up is AME, the average marginal effect. This is, I would say, generally considered the gold standard in modern research.
Okay, so how do we calculate it?
You basically embrace the complexity. You go to your spreadsheet, and for every single one of those 872 workers, you calculate their specific marginal effect based on their specific age. So you end up with a new column in your data with 872 different effects.
And then what?
Then you just take the average of that entire column. The formula is just 1 over n times the sum of all those individual marginal effects.
Simple enough conceptually. It's the true average of all the individual effects.
Correct. And the reason it's so good is that it represents how the population on average responds to a change. It fully respects the actual distribution of people in your data. It's the most robust and honest method.
Okay, so that's AME. What's the next method? MEM. Marginal effect at the mean.
This one is more of a shortcut. Instead of calculating 872 different effects, you first calculate the average person. You find the mean age of the sample, the mean education, the mean of everything. We can call that X bar.
So we create this hypothetical Frankenstein's monster of a person who is exactly 43.31 years old and has the exact average education.
Exactly. And then you calculate the marginal effect just once for that one hypothetical average person. So MEM is the marginal effect evaluated at X bar.
I can see why that's easier computationally. You're only doing the math one time.
It is much easier. But it can be very misleading. What if the average person doesn't actually exist in reality? Or what if your data is bimodal? You have a lot of young people and a lot of old people, but almost nobody in the middle.
Oh, right.
The average person might be in a valley between two peaks in your data. So the MEM might be describing a situation that applies to literally no one in your sample.
That's a great point. It's the average family has 2.5 children problem. No family actually has half a child. So MEM is risky if the distribution is weird. Okay, what about the last one? MAR.
Marginal effect at a representative value. This is where you, the researcher, get to be a bit of a curator. You say, you know what? I'm not interested in the overall average. I'm specifically interested in what happens to 30-year-olds. So you choose to set your representative value, X star, to 30.
And what do you do with the other variables in the model, say some other variable Z?
Well, there's some nuance there. You can either use the specific individual values of Z and average those, or you can also set Z to a specific representative value, Z star. The key thing is that you are choosing the context because you want to tell a specific story.
This seems like it would be the most useful for policy analysis. You could say, here is the impact on new graduates, or here's the impact on people nearing retirement.
Exactly. It lets you target specific groups of interest. So to recap for implementation, AME averages everyone's individual effect. MEM calculates the effect for the one average person. And MR lets you pick a specific interesting point to analyze.
And the good news for students is we don't usually have to do this by hand for 872 people, right?
Oh, no. Thank goodness. Most statistical packages, Stata, R, Python, they have post-estimation commands that will calculate these for you. And crucially, they'll also give you the standard errors and confidence intervals for them.
Perfect. So let's move on to section three and actually apply this. The quadratic model. This is the first major type of transformation we're looking at using polynomials. So X and X squared.
The quadratic is the absolute workhorse of nonlinear modeling in economics. The equation looks like y hat equals b1 plus b2x plus b3x squared. And as we said before, visually, this creates a parabola.
A U-shape or a hill.
Right. If the coefficient on that squared term, the b3, is positive, the curve opens upward like a bowl. If b3 is negative, it opens downward like a hill.
And in labor economics, specifically when we're looking at earnings over a lifetime, we expect to see the hill, right? You start low, you earn more as you get experience, you peak somewhere in middle age, and then maybe you scale back or your earnings decline as you approach retirement.
We do. And the earnings complete data set confirms that expectation perfectly. When they regressed earnings on age and age squared, They got a positive coefficient for age, it was about plus 3105, and a negative coefficient for age squared, about minus 29.66.
So that negative sign on the squared term is what it eventually bends the line downwards. But how do we know if we actually need that squared term? How do we know it isn't just a straight line after all?
We gotta check for statistical significance. The t-statistic for that age squared term was, in absolute value, 2.38.
Okay, 2.38.
And since that's greater than the usual critical value of 1.96 for a 5% significance level, we can statistically reject the null hypothesis that the relationship is linear, the curve is real, the quadratic model is justified.
Okay, now let's get to the interpretation. We've established that the marginal effect changes. What is the specific formula for the marginal effect in a quadratic model?
Well, you just take the derivative of that equation, b1 plus b2x plus b3x squared with respect to x, and you get b2 plus 2 times b3 times x.
So the formula is b2 plus 2b3x.
Exactly. And that formula explicitly shows you how the effect of age changes as age, or x itself changes.
And the most interesting thing about a hill is the very top, the peak.
Yeah.
If I'm a worker, I want to know, at what age am I going to max out my earnings? How do we find that point mathematically?
That's the turning point. In a quadratic model, you can find the x value where the slope hits zero, the very peak of the hill, by setting that derivative we just found to zero and solving for x. The formula simplifies really nicely to negative b2 divided by 2 times b3.
Okay, let's do the mental math with our data set. We had b2 is 3105 and b3 is negative 29.66.
So you have negative 3105 divided by 2 times negative 29.66. The two negatives are going to cancel out.
Right.
And it works out to be roughly 52.3.
52.3 years old. That's the peak earning age in this data set.
According to this specific model, yes. It predicts that your earnings increase with age until you hit 52.3, and after that, they start to decline.
That is surprisingly specific. And it really illustrates why the simple linear model is so dangerous. If we had just run a straight line model, we would have concluded that earnings go up forever. We'd be telling a 60-year-old to expect a raise when the data actually says they might be expecting a pay cut.
Precisely. Now let's bring our AME concept in here. If we calculate the marginal effect for every person in the sample using that formula, 305 minus 59.32 times their age, and then average all of those effects.
We get the average marginal effect. What is it?
The AME of age on earnings is calculated to be $536.
Okay, let's unpack that number. $536.
What that means is if you pick a random person from the sample, on average, an extra year of age is associated with a $536 increase in earnings. But that average hides all the drama. For a 25-year-old, the value of another year is way, way higher than $536. For a 60-year-old, the value is actually negative. The AME is just the summary statistic of that whole distribution of effects.
Before we leave polynomials, is there a limit? Can we have age cubed? Age to the fourth power. Could we model a roller coaster if we wanted to?
You absolutely can. A polynomial of degree p allows for p minus 1 turning points. So a cubic model with an x cubed term has 2 turning points. It can go up, turn down, and then turn up again.
When would we ever use something like that?
Maybe in a complex life cycle model where you earn, then maybe you go back to school so your earnings drop, then you start earning again. But the general selection strategy here is what we call parsimony. You want the simplest model that fits the data.
So you progressively add terms, x squared, x cubed, and so on.
Until the newest term you added is statistically insignificant.
So if the cubic term has a low t-stat, you cut it and just stick with the quadratic.
Exactly. In labor economics, the quadratic usually does the job just fine.
Got it. Let's shift gears to section 4. Interacted regressors. This is one of my favorite concepts because it explains so much of the complexity in the world.
This is what I call the it depends model. Yeah. The structure here is y equals beta 1 plus beta 2x plus beta 3z plus beta 4 times the product of x and z. You literally create a new variable in your spreadsheet that is column x multiplied by column z.
So why would we mash two variables together like that? What's the intuition?
Because we suspect that the effect of one variable is conditioned by the level of the other. For example, does the value of an extra year of education stay the same regardless of how old you are? Or does that education actually pay off more as you gain experience?
I would hope it pays off more. I mean, experience should leverage the education, right? A degree in the hands of a veteran CEO is probably worth more than in the hands of a junior analyst.
That's the exact hypothesis. So in the book, they look at an interaction model with earnings, age, and education, and they create a new variable called age be a Duke.
And this leads to what the source calls the interpretation challenge.
It does. And this is where so many students get tripped up. When you include that interaction term, the marginal effect of age, which is our x variable, is no longer just b2. It becomes b2 plus b4 times z.
So the effect of age now depends on the level of your education.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And it works the other way, too. The marginal effect of education now depends on your age. It couples them together.
Okay, so let's look at the case study results, because something really weird and, frankly, disturbing happened when they ran this interaction model.
Yes, it did. The p-values went haywire.
Totally haywire.
In the simple model, without the interaction, age and education were both stars. Highly significant, low p-values. But when they added the interaction term age Berludic, the individual p-values for age and education shot way up. They suddenly looked statistically insignificant.
Which would cause a student to panic. Did that mean age and education suddenly stopped mattering?
No, and this is a classic trap. This is caused by a problem called multicollinearity.
Multicollinearity.
Just think about it for a second. The variable age is obviously going to be correlated with the variable age times education. If your age goes up, the product of age and education is probably going to go up. They move together. In the data, the correlation coefficients were really high, like 0.72 and 0.64.
So the model gets confused. It sees the variation in earnings, but it can't decide if it should give the credit to the age variable or to the age times education variable.
That's a perfect way to put it. It's like two people are driving a car with one steering wheel. You can't tell who is actually turning the car. And because the model is so uncertain, the standard errors inflate. In this case, they tripled. And big standard errors mean small t stats and bad high p values.
So how do we fix this? We can't just drop the variables because we think the interaction is important.
No, you can't drop them. If you drop them, you're creating omitted variable bias, which is a worse sin. The solution is to change how you test your hypothesis. You must ignore the individual t-test for the variables that are involved in the interaction. Instead, you perform a joint f-test.
The joint f-test. So we're testing them as a team.
Correct. You ask the model a different question. You ask, do age and the age interaction term jointly have an effect of zero?
And what was the verdict from the f-test?
The p-value for testing age and its interaction jointly was 0.002, highly significant.
So age definitely matters as a package deal.
And for education and its interaction jointly, the p-value was 0.000. So education matters, too. The variables are significant, but they're just too entangled to be separated individually. The f-test cuts right through that confusion.
Okay, so once we trust the model because of the f-test, what's the payoff? What did the interaction actually tell us about the relationship between age, education, and earnings?
Well, the calculation showed that the marginal effect of education was equal to 4.515 plus 29 times age.
Okay, let's decode that. The base value of a year of education is about $4,500. But that plus sign, that means for every additional year you age, the value of that education goes up by another $29.
That's exactly it. A 50-year-old gets more financial return from their degree than a 25-year-old does. The financial return on education increases as you get older.
That is a fascinating insight. It adds so much more nuance than just saying education is good. It depends, really, is the answer to everything in economics.
It really is. Okay, let's move on to section 5, logarithmic models. This is where we stop talking about absolute dollars and start talking about percentages. Log models are everywhere in economics. Income, prices, sales, so many things tend to move in percentage terms. And we have two main flavors here, the log linear and the log log.
Let's separate them. First, log linear. This is where your dependent variable, y, is logged, so you have ly, but your x variable is just linear.
So the equation is ly equals b1 plus b2x. How do we read that b2 coefficient here?
In this model, b2 represents what we call a semi-elasticity, and the rule is a 1-unit change in x leads to a 102% change in y.
You have to multiply by 100.
Multiply by 100. Let's use the data set. They regress the log of earnings on age. The coefficient on age was 0.000078.
So we multiplied 0.000078 by 100, which gives us 0.78. So the interpretation is one additional year of age is associated with a 0.78% increase in earnings.
Not 78%, 0.78%.
Right, less than 1%.
Correct. Always multiply by 100. And if you want to know what that is in dollars, you have to do a little more math. The marginal effect in dollars is B2 times Y hat. So 0.78% of the mean earnings of $56,369 is about $440.
Okay, so that's log linear. Note about the double log. log log ln y xb1 plus b2 ln x.
This is the elasticity model, and this one is the cleanest interpretation of all. A 1% change in x leads to a b2% change in y.
Percent. No multiplying by 100 needed for the coefficient part.
None needed. The example here is log earnings on log age. The coefficient they get is 0.346.
So a 1% increase in age is associated with a 0.346% increase in earnings.
Right. This is what we'd call an inelastic response. Earnings go up, but they go up slower than age does in percentage terms. The marginal effect formula here, if you need it, is b 2 times y hat over x.
I find log-log models so elegant. But, and there's always a but, isn't there? There's a massive trap waiting for us in Section 6, prediction and retransformation bias.
This sounds like a problem from a sci-fi movie, retransformation bias. But it is a very real mathematical issue that catches almost everyone the first time they try to make a forecast with one of these models.
Okay, so what's the scenario? Lay it out for us.
So you run your model for the log of y. You get a predicted value for a specific person. Let's say the predicted L earnings for someone is 11.
Okay, but I don't pay my rent in log dollars. I need to know the actual dollars. So the natural instinct is just to reverse the log. Take the exponent of 11.
That seems perfectly logical. But it is wrong. That is what we call the naive prediction.
Why is it wrong?
It's because of a quirk in mathematics called Jensen's inequality. The short version is that the expected value of the log is not the same as the log of the expected value. Basically, the logarithm function compresses large numbers more than it compresses small numbers. Because of this, the expected value of e to the u is always greater than 1. And if you just exponentiate the predicted log, you will systematically underpredict the real value.
You will consistently guess too low.
Every single time. You need a correction factor. If we're willing to assume that your error terms are normally distributed and homoscedastic, meaning they have a constant variance, c squared, then the correction formula is to multiply your naive prediction by the exponent of c squared divided by 2.
Okay, hold on. That's sc squared, where e is the standard error of the regression.
Correct.
And we divide that by 2 and then take e to that power.
That's the one. The full formula for the corrected prediction is y tilde equals xac2, xplnys hat. Let's look at the numbers to see how big a deal this can be. In our example, the standard error of the regression, sc, was 0.4.
Okay, so we square 0.4, which is 0.1 sing.
Mm-hmm.
Then we divide that by 2, which gives us 0.08. Then we take e to the power of 0.08.
Which is roughly 1.083. So you need to scale up your naive prediction by 8.3%.
That's a really significant error if you're trying to forecast a budget or a salary. You'd be missing nearly 10% of the money just because of bad math.
Exactly. So for the exam, remember the two steps. Calculate the naive prediction, then multiply by that correction factor, xp at sc2.
And there's another warning here about using r squared in log models, right?
Yes, a huge one. Never, ever compare the r squared between a model that predicts y and a model that predicts ln y.
Why not? I thought r squared was supposed to be the universal measure of how well a model fits.
It is, but it measures the proportion of variance explained. And in one model, you are explaining the variance of dollars, which might be in the billions. In the other, you're explaining the variance of log dollars, which might range from 1 to 15. They are totally different units.
It's like comparing apples to log apples.
Exactly. And what usually happens is that the log model's R squared looks higher because logging the data tends to compress the outliers, especially with right skewed data like income. It makes the cloud of points look tighter. But that's a mirage. You can't be fooled into thinking the log model is better just because its R squared is higher. You just can't compare them directly.
That is a great tip.
Yeah.
Okay, let's bring all of this home with Section 7, the comprehensive example. The source material basically throws everything into the pot. This is the kitchen sink model.
This is the final boss battle of the chapter. They run a single regression of log earnings on just about everything. Gender, age squared, education, a dummy for self-employment, a dummy for government employment, and log hours worked. It's a mix of levels, quadratics, dummies, and logs all at once.
Okay, let's run through the key takeaways from this mega model and see if we can interpret them on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
First up, gender. The coefficient is negative 0.193.
The dependent variable is log earnings. So for a dummy variable like gender, this is a semi-elasticity. It means women earn approximately 19.3% less than men, holding all those other factors, education, hours, age constant. That is a stark and statistically significant gap.
Next, self-employment. The coefficient is negative 0.118.
That suggests that self-employed people earn 11.8% less. However, and this is key, the p-value for this coefficient was high. It was statistically insignificant.
So from a statistical point of view, we treat that difference as zero.
That's right. We cannot reject the null hypothesis that self-employed and private sector workers earn the same once we control for everything else. We shouldn't make a big story out of that negative 11.8% because it's very likely just statistical noise.
Okay. What about hours worked? The variable was log hours and the coefficient was 0.975.
This is a log-log relationship. So a 1% increase in hours worked leads to a 0.975% increase in earnings.
That's almost exactly one-to-one.
It is. We call that unitary elasticity. If you work 10% more, you make about 10% more. It suggests that, in this aggregate view, hourly wages are fairly constant, regardless of how many hours you work. There's no huge overtime premium or part-time penalty showing up.
And finally, what about the age curve? Did the peak age change from our simple quadratic model we talked about earlier?
It did, slightly. Remember, in the simple model, the peak earnings age was 52.3 years. In this much more complex model, where we're controlling for education hours and gender, the turning point shifts down a little to 51.0 years.
So once you account for the fact that people work different hours and have different levels of education, the pure effect of age on earnings seems to peak a little bit earlier.
Exactly. And this demonstrates why adding those control variables is so important. It refines our understanding. The simple model might have been mixing the effect of age with the fact that older people perhaps work different hours. This complex model separates those effects.
This has been a massive download of information. We've gone from simple lines to curves, interactions, logarithms. Let's wrap this all up with a quick study guide summary of the big three transformations we covered.
Okay, the big three.
Quadratics. Use them when you suspect a turning point. You're looking for that U-shape or hill. And remember the formula, negative B2 over 2B3, to find the peak.
Number two.
Interactions. Use them when the answer is, it depends. The marginal effect of X depends on Z. But watch out for multicollinearity. Trust the joint F test, not the individual T stats.
And number three.
Logs. Use them when you're thinking in percentages. Log linear is a semi-elasticity, so remember to multiply by 100. Log-log is an elasticity percent for percent. And please, never forget the retransformation correction factor, X22, when you're predicting back to dollars.
And ruling over all of them is the central idea of the marginal effect. And the calculus method, DXX, is your best friend for calculating it.
Indeed. It's the precise speedometer for your nonlinear road trip.
And to leave you with a little brain teaser, a final provocation from the source material, try to solve these in your head or on a napkin later, just to make sure you have the mechanics down. So, question one. If your model is y hat equals 2 plus 3x plus 4x squared, and the mean of x in your sample is 2, what is the marginal effect at the mean?
All right, let's walk through the derivative. The derivative of 2 is 0. The derivative of 3x is 3. The derivative of 4x squared is 2 times 4 times x, which is 8x. So the formula for the marginal effect is 3 plus 8x.
And you just plug in the mean of 2?
Right, 3 plus 8 times 2. That's 3 plus 16. The marginal effect is 19.
Perfect. And question 2. If you have a log model, LNY equals 1 plus 2x, and the standard error of the regression, SE, is 0.3, what is the expected value of y given x?
The trap is, don't just compute xp 1 plus 2x. You have to remember to multiply by the correction factor, x of 0.3 squared divided by 2.
If you can do those two problems, you're in pretty good shape for the exam.
And if you can explain why you did that to your roommate without them falling asleep, you're ready for an A.
Thanks for diving deep with us today. Keep crunching those numbers and watch out for those retransformation biases.
See you next time.